Computer. Hi, this is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking to Francis Kirkham, Navy brat. Or do you prefer Navy Junior?
Actually, I do.
Okay. So we will think about that. Very many of our military brats are brats, and but there are quite a few that say, wait, no, Navy Junior, Marine Junior. So good. I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this podcast. We're talking about your new memoir, Fly Butterfly Fly. So Francis, I have to tell you, I just plunged right into the book and I was quite a ways into it before I realized that the character in the book's name was Anna, which is not your name. And then I went back and realized it was a fictionalized memoir. And so I wanted to know, why did you make this a fictionalized memoir?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to be your guest today. I'm delighted. And I'm particularly happy that you asked this important question. It was not my idea to make it a fictionalized memoir, but it was my editor's. She was concerned that because the details of this story go back 60 years, and many of them are unverifiable, and a lot of the places no longer exist, as well as my not knowing if any of these people are still alive, that there were privacy issues. So I made the difficult decision. However, I have to couch all of this by saying that the stories I told are all true to the best of my memory. And the same is true for the depictions of the characters and the locales. It's just that I needed a little distance.
So why actually did it take you so long to write your story? I mean, 60 years is a long time to all of a sudden say, hey, I'm going to write a book. And then once you did start writing your book, how long did it take?
Okay. Well, I've always liked to write, and I do come from a family of writers. And I'm interested in family and interpersonal dynamics. In my 20s, I began thinking about what it would be like to write a book, but it was a dream for the future. It was way too early. Then in my 30s, I wrote my master's thesis, and that's when I discovered that I absolutely adored the addictive feeling of getting lost in the written word. Hours could just fly by and I didn't want to stop. So I was sad when my thesis was finished, but I knew that someday I would write a book. And I retired about 50, and that's when I started actually writing short stories about the family and travels. And one by one, I filled up a binder, but as it often does, life kept getting in the way with other distractions. But now that I look back on it, I think that that was really a good thing because I still wasn't ready for the challenge of writing memoir. It's a lot more than people think it is. Even if you're, even though it's your own story, you have to do a lot of personal digging to get ready to write that. And I was not ready. But it turned out that it was about 2012 when I finally had the time, the energy, and was in the right place that I decided to start pulling those stories together. It took 10 years. I had a lot of going back and looking at family dynamics, really trying to get honest with myself and say, when things went wrong, how much of it was my fault? What was my part in all of this? Because I'm aware that when you write memoir, people don't want to be bogged down with too much heavy information. So it was a matter of getting clear with myself and putting responsibility where it belonged. So it took 10 years.
We're going to double back to some of the statements you made just now,
Okay.
because I think they're important when you write a memoir. I can barely remember what I had for breakfast today. And your book is so richly detailed, and you said you had to go back and dig and things like that. Did you keep journals as a kid?
Well, you know, this is a reflection of my military upbringing. I did when I was pretty young, I would say, you know, late elementary, early junior high school. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they didn't survive very long because we were always moving. Mm-hmm. And those were considered kind of dispensable items when it came to packing up time.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh,
I know.
I am so sorry.
But, you know, I can go in my drawer in my office now and I have a ton of journals that were written in the last 15 years. Mm. So at least, you know, I have those. Mm. But, you know, you might ask how it is that I can remember all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of it goes back to that military training. Mm-hmm. My brother and I learned very, very well to be seen and not heard. Mm-hmm. You know, we watched and listened to what was going on around us, but we just packed it away like squirrels. And then there were the stories that my dad told that, you know, were recounted in the book. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I was 10 years old when all of that started. And it just really, I was old enough to absorb it and curious enough to ask questions. Mm-hmm. So it was like bees to honey. Mm-hmm. And it just, the old memory went to work. The memory replaced the journals.
You mentioned, you know, that the detail and the research, and that this is your story, although it's fictionalized in parts. What kind of research did you do to write the book, in addition to your family, going back to your family stories? So what kind of research did you do to write this book, if any? And you can hear my dog in the background. He's guarding us from unicorns out there. And since it's your story, why would doing research be important?
Well, once again, I have to credit my editor. She wanted me to enlarge the scope of the book beyond just me and the family. Mm-hmm. And I immediately liked that idea. I could see the wisdom behind her suggestion. Mm-hmm. And so I chose to interweave small historical segments, but I wanted to do it with a light touch. Mm-hmm. But in order even to do that, I needed to do it accurately. I'm kind of a picky that way.
Right.
So actually, I can give you a couple examples. I imagine that not too many people have ever heard of the island of Kwajalein. We can talk about that in a bit, but it has quite a history, but because it's a secret destination, I really didn't know much about it, even though I had lived there. So in order to write what I termed the Itty Bitty Guide to Kwajalein and the Marshall Islands, mm-hmm. Which appears in the appendix,
right,
I had to follow that historical trail. Mm-hmm. And then also, when I was writing about the Japanese royal family, I needed to go back and verify dates and names mm-hmm. of the various treaties that changed the emperor's powers following World War II. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that really changed the whole course of history for Japan once the emperor was no longer considered this very special hallowed person. But again, I needed to go back and do research, although I knew some things.
Right.
And so I did include quite a few of those resources in the section called Further Reading. It's at the end of the book, mm-hmm. if people want to check some of that out. Mm-hmm. It was my editor's suggestion.
Well, and also stepping back 60 years, you'd get you'd have a better perspective now as an adult than as a kid, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I saw things that I never saw there in doing the research.
Yeah. Well, I really thoroughly enjoyed learning about some of these places. I had never heard of Kwajalein. And then all of a sudden on Facebook, there's been four or five people that have lived there. And I'm like, wow. What are the odds? So Anna, the character, has a brother in the book, and you just said you have a brother well. Okay. Did you consult your brother or other family members when you were working on this book, or did you do it alone? And now that it's done, what have been the reactions of your family?
Well, this might surprise you. Mm-hmm. All of my family has passed away.
Hmm.
You know, that would include my brother, mm-hmm. and he had no children. My mother, who had no siblings. My father and his only sibling, a sister, who had no children. Wow. And I'm widowed and have no children. So, and I started the book so recently, none of my family members ever knew or saw stories about the family. All they knew was that I wanted to write a book someday.
Oh, you know, I've got chills. That's kind of, you are the spokesperson for two generations there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That that isn't a question I was even going to ask because I had no clue, but it's your destiny or you are the historian for these people. And that's a huge Definitely. Responsibility. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. You know, I think that was some of the real push for me to write it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I realized, you know, without children, when I die, mm-hmm. that history is all gone. And maybe nobody else will care about it, but I do.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of how we started the museum, because there's so much history in military families, and who's recording that history for perpetuity?
Right.
Okay, wow. All right. Okay, interview over now. I'm just going to dig right into it then. So because this is your kind of your family legacy, and the memoir is based on real people, and you mentioned it a little bit, you alluded to it. What do you as an author owe the people that you describe?
Well, excuse me. I owe them honesty as best I can express it. And I feel that the fact that they have all died doesn't change that. As you say, it is the family legacy. It's something that, although it's checkered in certain spots, that I'm very proud of. And I believe that everything happens for a reason. And that's a topic that you might have run into in the book. And in this case, life arranged itself such that I wasn't ready to write or able to write the book until my family had died. And I had that more mature perspective mm-hmm. that you spoke of.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things happening, you know, they came together and allowed me to write it honestly. I know there are a lot of authors that really struggle with that. If their family members are still alive, how do they handle that?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that was not a challenge at all. I was totally free to write any and everything that I wanted. And I had the grace of sparing everyone hard feelings and regrets. And you might ask, mm-hmm. you know, what would my family have thought about this? You kind of alluded to that.
Right.
And our family lived by see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Mm-hmm.
They would not, well, my parents would not have approved of my writing about the family, certainly not in such a forthcoming manner. However, my brother would have cheered me on.
Yeah.
He would have been right there with me. Yeah. I don't know if he would have written it, but he would have cheered me on.
Well, you know, and I know what you're talking about, because I read the book. I thought you were very respectful and restrained. And so I think you did a good job of telling the story, but not exposing things. You know, mm-hmm. I thought you did it very nicely. And so I think you did, you were honest and you were respectful all at the same time. So for example, in your book, you admit to at one point being disappointed in your father. You know, you were a teenager. I mean, we're all disappointed when we're teenagers. did you ever reconcile that completely and then see him in a different light as you grew up?
Well, you know, my father and I happen to be very similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a hardworking, honest man who always provided for us. Mm-hmm. And he did the very best he could, given his history and the constraints of the time, some of which came directly out of the military. But, you know, he was rigid, judgmental, and stubborn, just like me.
The apple part, right?
yeah. So as I said, you know, I had to do a lot of work on myself to get to an honest place. But I can tell you that he died suddenly in the early 90s. And there have been so many times that I wish that I could have talked to him and tried to clear up some of the issues that still stood between us, because that stubbornness and that needing to be right didn't end in me for a very long time. So I wish I could have made more amends, and that he was assured that I loved and forgave him, because I absolutely did. And a lot of that actually came through writing the book. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of tears as I went along. Mm-hmm. But that's part of the process of writing memoir. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, you know, I was 46 when he died, and we were still kind of duking it out.
Well, you know, I think this pandemic has made a lot of us think about what is important, you know, maybe trying to heal family wounds. I mean, because you could be alive one day and dead the next day, you know. And so I think a lot of us have been thinking about people in our lives that have rifted with us, or, you know, let them go or try to make amends. So switching the subject, I live in Navy housing right now in Oahu, and I was really sad when your book ended just as you arrived in Hawaii, because I had been learning about other places, and I would have been interested in reading your assessment of Honolulu and comparing it to my own experiences. But you did give a few references, like you went to the University of Hawaii, and I just went down to the University of Hawaii yesterday to check it out. So that I could imagine where you were there. So I think I know the answer to this question, but you know what they say about assuming. But because your book ends as you enter college, so you were very young, I need to ask, where has your favorite place been to live ever?
Well, I have to go back to Japan. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's what you thought.
That's what I thought, but you never know.
You never know. But only during my dad's assignment time. When I went back decades later, it couldn't compare. And I think that's an experience that most people have when they try to go back to places. But I was young, you know, when I lived in Japan the first time, and it was such an incredibly rich experience. I don't think it ever could have compared. Mm-hmm. So there were definitely changes in Japan that were disappointing. But there was always going to be something. I was always going to be disappointed.
Right.
But, you know, I have friends in Japan. They often ask me when I'm going to come visit them. And it's a difficult question, because a lot of me feels like it's a chapter that I should leave closed, because what I loved about it is no longer there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that was definitely my favorite place. But it was a combination, I think, of the time in my life.
Right. I think a lot of brats, a lot of military kids and spouses, you know, struggle with that, because you do want to go home, but you can't mm-hmm. go home.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There is no home. Yeah.
There is no home. One sentence in your book really grabbed me, so I wanted you to elaborate on it. You wrote, "A child of the world operates on an eclectic framework of philosophies and customs." What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I've been very fortunate to live in Asia, the Pacific Rim, Europe, the Middle East, mm-hmm. and East, West, North, and South in the U.S. So... You know, and I was traveling before I was a year old. So it forced me to really be open to other ways of thinking and doing things. It really fostered my curiosity. So what happened is that as I went to these various places and I'm looking around at the cultures, I found things that I wanted to adopt, you know, whether it was a belief or a custom, but it was something that touched me and felt like it matched my values. And it didn't matter that it was coming from a different culture. It just felt like it was adding more and variety to who I wanted to be. In fact, I can kind of tell you a funny story that was evolving in the 60s and 70s when I was in Hawaii, where, as you know, there are many Japanese people there. But my friends would look at me kind of with a curious expression and say, "You're so Japanese." But for me, that was a compliment because I had identified so completely with the culture. Mm-hmm. But for the people who were saying that to me, it wasn't. They wanted me to be their idea of American apple pie.
Right.
I was a threat to them in some way. And I guess because they couldn't understand what it was all about. But I loved that I was able to connect with Japan in that way and, you know, adopt some of their beliefs and cultural mannerisms. And if you'd like, I can give you a little example of that.
Yeah, no. So let me just throw this out. So I think you did succeed in becoming a child of the world then. So give us an example.
Okay. Well, the Japanese are, well, New Year's is their favorite holiday. They really are invested in that. So it's got a lot of symbolism for them. And so at the end of every year, they spend a lot of time and effort cleaning up their homes and their businesses. And they pay off their debts and they go around and make amends to people they feel that they've offended because they want to start the new year clean and fresh. Well, I absolutely love that. And so I've incorporated it into my own way of living. And whereas, you know, people in America may spend all their time and energy getting ready for Christmas, that's kind of on the back burner for me. It's New Year's because I want to be on the cusp of the new year with no garbage or recycling in the house and no bills to be paid and no lingering unexpressed apologies and even clean sheets on the bed. I'm kind of really into that. And yet it comes from that culture and it makes me feel close to Japan, particularly at New Year's.
Very cool. Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah. So switching gears and thinking about writing and process, I'd like to ask some questions about your writing. Why do you think your story, and I think you've already said this, but now for people who are considering writing their memoir, why do you think a story or any memoir for that matter should actually be written?
Okay, well, you know, a lot of people scoff at memoir. They think it's self-indulgent and sappy, and for heaven's sakes, it certainly can be. But I believe that good memoir can teach people about new ways, new avenues and things for them to explore and to help them find hidden parts of themselves. It's a learning opportunity. And certainly for me, as I've read memoir, discovering that other people share some of my thoughts, feelings, and experiences has been incredibly normalizing and healing. So that's been a lot of what's motivated me and what I think motivates other people. They feel that they have something of value to share. Whether or not that's true, of course, is another issue. But I would like to say that for all the writers out there, I think that, and it's been intimated here already, that I think that we have to write memoirs for ourselves before we can write memoirs for others.
Right.
Certainly many of my early stories were rooted in trying to come to terms with my past.
Right.
And it meant having to ask those painful questions. But, you know, it was only after I had done that, that I knew the messages I wanted to impart in my memoir and what voice I needed to match that. So I don't know. I really love memoir because of the opportunities that it opens up for people to learn about themselves through others.
So what do you think are some common traps that aspiring writers might fall into?
Well, there are a bunch of them.
Enlighten us, because I have no idea. I wrote that question. I was like, I don't even know what that means. So I'm glad you know.
Well, you know, I think especially if we're really devoted to what it is that we're trying to write, we kind of get a little bit too full of ourselves and think that we don't need any help. Actually, that's when we need lots and lots of it. So one recommendation that I would make to people who are thinking about wanting to publish is to invest in the services of an editor.
Mm-hmm.
Expensive, and it may have you looking at things that you didn't necessarily want to consider in terms of your structure, but I just found that it was so incredibly important and valuable to me. But of course, you know, if you're going to pay for that, then you have to listen to the advice that you're given.
Right. That's hard for some people because
it is.
This person doesn't know my story. I know my story. There's an ego involved. Yeah.
Exactly. There's a lot of ego, especially when you're starting out. You haven't had enough tumbles yet to know that you need help. So, you know, maybe people can start out early by getting some help. So that would be one. Another one would be actually not treating your writing as a top priority and failing to put in your chair time. There's going to be a lot of it where you don't really produce anything that you end up using, or you think you're going to use it and later on you wind up throwing it out, but it's all necessary part and parcel of the process. On the other hand, you know, if people are like me and they love to write, then they're going to have the opposite problem. I can't find enough time to write.
Yeah, that's my thing. I'm a scheduler, a list maker. And so I'm working on 3 writing projects at once. And it's like, I'm going to walk and dictate into my phone. And that'll count as one of the writing projects. It's awful. Yeah, writers are driven to write.
And don't you love checking off those things?
I do. I just love writing. So did you have any more?
Yeah, actually, I've got one more. And with these, I'm thinking about people who are, you know, fairly new in the process. And that's, they make a mistake of trying to rush the process. And for a long time, you know, people kept talking to me about publication. And I just refused. It was like, I want to be in the writing process. Publication is down the line and maybe I'll never get there. But that actually turned out to be a wonderful piece of advice because then I was just able to sit back and put in the time and get lost in revising and learning about myself and about the craft, which is what I needed to do. But I'd also say that, you know, people get hung up. They write all this stuff and then they're afraid to put it out there and have other people read it.
Right.
And that's really a necessary part of it. You need feedback from other people.
Yeah, I think that is one of the things that a lot of people struggle with. I've written this and now I don't think it's good enough. And I don't really want people to tell me it's not good enough. But in reality, it might be really good. It's just that you've got that kind of self-doubt. Wow.
So true.
So I know you're involved in a writing group.
Yes.
And so I wanted to know what other authors are you friends with and, you know, how they helped you become a better writer. And is that where you found your editor? I know a lot of people are always asking, where can I find an editor? Or would you be happy to, you know, proofread for me? And, you know, so I will recap because that was a lot of words. You're in a writing group. What other authors are you friends with? How do they help you? And is that where you found your editor?
Okay, well, prior to joining the writing group, I took both online and in-person classes. Mm-hmm. And of course, I acquired a small library of books on writing techniques. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that one of those classes is where I found my editor. And she is from New Mexico. She's from Santa Fe. And she is, of course, an author herself. So she is my primary help in terms of being an editor and author and a support system. But I also felt that, you know, she wasn't available to me at all times, and I needed a group. And the one that I joined was already established, but it's remained very stable. I've been with them for about 5 years, and very few people have come and gone. There are about 8 to 10 of us, and both male and female, and we're split between published and unpublished, but on the path. And we share leadership of our meetings, and we're just the most wonderful, ready support services for each other, and inspiration. And I don't know, are you interested in any of the dynamics of how that group works?
Well, so I just joined a writer's group, and I have not really joined groups before. And so I want to know, I guess, because I have only attended one meeting, how do they support you? How do the dynamics work? Did you take pieces of your book and read it out loud, and they said, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense, you need to fix it? Or how does that work?
That work? Okay. Well, we meet in person. I have to qualify that, when COVID is not controlling us.
Zoom.
We can Zoom for quite a while. But otherwise, we meet in person twice a month. And at each meeting, we review a total of between 30 and 40 pages of written work. And it generally comes from two people, two members of the group. They send their 15, 20 pages each to us about 10 days before the meeting. And we mark up their submissions with comments, suggestions, and grammatical corrections. And then when we get together, we share a prepared written critique that we've made, which covers not so much the things that we marked up on their actual submissions, but just our impressions, the things that we really liked, the things that tripped us up, the obvious areas that were weak and needed work. So when you walk away from there, you take those marked up pages from all the group members, and you go home and you've got that to review and decide what you want to keep and what you want to throw out. And it's just incredible.
Wow, that is really, that you are definitely vulnerable. I mean, you go home and lick your wounds, maybe.
Well, I think it depends on the group. And that would have been my last comment, which would be, make sure you find the group that's right for you.
Right.
And you know when you found it. Where we've been together, well, I've been in the group over 5 years, and we are such good friends now. We know people's vulnerabilities. We trust each other. I know that they're going to tell me what I need to do, what I need to fix. But they're also going to give me enough praise that I can handle the incoming negativity, and it's always couched in caring.
Right.
Because we don't take it personally.
You know, I think that's good advice, to shop around and find the writer's group. Or maybe there's a writer's group, but they have different people leading the sessions. You know, like one weekend it's Mary, and one weekend it's Joe, and one weekend it's, you know, somebody else. And then maybe you find that you really like Joe's session the best, and you go to that one as opposed to, you know, going to something that you're really not connecting with. So I think that's good advice. Shop around and find the right group for you, the right fit. And don't be intimidated. And you know, because the right group is out there for you.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people are doing online groups. And that has never been something that I really wanted to do. It didn't feel intimate and close enough. And surprisingly, even though we only did Zoom sometime last year, and we'd all been together for a very long time, we felt the same way about Zoom as I feel about joining a group, another group online. It was, we lost our intimacy. We could see each other, but it was different than sitting together.
Right.
And being able to be more, I don't know, it was just warm and comfy.
Right. So I would
say, but you know, there's people that of all stripes. So you might want to look at in online things as well as in-person groups and see what really fits.
Right.
But they're really invaluable.
So we talked a little bit about your process for the book. You know, you had started to write out the stories years ago and just keep them in a binder. But when you started writing this book for real, did you block out the chapters ahead of time? Did you make a timeline? Did you, how did you set up your writing process to create this book? Because it's chronological.
Well, actually that was the operative word, chronological. Because it was chronological, I didn't really need to do an outline. I just called my stories. I knew already what I wanted to speak to, where I wanted it to go, and just pulled out those stories. And I was able to kind of put them together. Of course, I've had to write other stories around them, expand it from there, but it was not a formal outline at all.
Okay.
And it, another, you know, after doing 3 full rewrites, thanks to my editor, it's nothing like where it started out. It's the same, well, it's the same story, but it's told in a different way. But I need chronology was what helped me to do that without an outline.
Yeah. So I know you had a teacher in Yo-Hi that inspired you, that maybe even lit the spark that led to your writing career. Who was that?
Well, his name was Mr. Findlay, and he taught English when I was a junior at Yo-Hi.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was a quiet, unassuming man, but he took the time and made the effort to get to know all of his students. He reached out to each one of us one-on-one. And for me, that was a turning point. It made all the difference because until I met him, I had never liked school.
Mm-hmm.
I was an introverted, shy little kid. And I always felt put down and misunderstood by my teachers,
mm-hmm.
and thought of myself as a class misfit. But Mr. Findlay honed in on my writing ability, and then he went to work on my self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gone into the 11th grade, a C student, but I made the honor roll by the end of the fall semester, stayed on it. And I actually think if it hadn't been for Mr. Findlay, I might not have gotten into college. I was really skidding on the edges.
Wow. You know, so that I want to just to throw in something. So that's a DODEA school. You know, back then it was not called that. But, you know, the Defense Department schools have just celebrated their 75th anniversary. I don't know if you knew that, but you were there in the very early days of
very early. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you experienced, you know, the beginnings of what has become a remarkable school system. And one of the things even today that stand out when people talk about DODEA is the quality of the teachers, the dedication of the teachers, the richness of opportunities that going to school overseas, offers. So Mr. Findlay at Yo-Hi, but I really liked your female teacher in kindergarten. I did. I want you to tell our listeners a bit more about her. And then for my own edification, did you keep in touch with her?
Okay. Well, her name was Dolores Jameson in the book. And she was a tiny dynamo. She taught upper level English and history. And this was in the fall of 61.
Mm-hmm.
And I just showed up for my senior year when I met her.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to teaching, she also worked tirelessly on several committees and was the senior class advisor. You never saw her sitting down for very long.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to the senior class, she had a single-minded goal to make our last year of high school as normal and memorable as possible, which was saying a lot given what Kwajalein was like.
You had like four kids in your senior class, yes. Five, right?
Well, we started out with four and ended up with five. Right. That was the first year that they even had a senior class. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Prior to that, senior class kids, you know, they lived with relatives back in the mainland, or they went to boarding school, mm-hmm. Or they took correspondence courses. Mm-hmm. They, you know, for the four previous years, they had added a high school year every year. Mm-hmm. So all of the classes were very small. I think the junior class was 10 students, something like that. So if you put that over what you're trying to do to make it memorable for students, she had a really tough job.
Right.
But she also had a really tough bunch of students. We couldn't have been more unlike. Mm-hmm. And we didn't particularly get along. So, mm-hmm. You know.
At least it was only four.
Spoil the story.
You could put one in each corner and then you'd be done with it. I mean, can you imagine 30 kids that didn't get along? Not enough corners.
Exactly.
did you keep in touch with her?
Actually not. And you know, when I left, I went directly to Hawaii, and a couple of weeks later I was starting at the university. And so life just completely shifted, and Kwajalein just fell off my fell off my calendar. Yeah. And so I didn't keep up with her, but I think I knew when I left that I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. That was so much the way I don't know if it's still that way in the military, but certainly when I was part of it, that's the way friendships were. You just knew you were going to lose people. And yeah. So you didn't.
Yeah, it still is. I'm a military spouse, and I remember I lived somewhere for a year on my own. My husband was back in New Mexico, and I was in Massachusetts, and I remember making one friend, and we did everything together in Massachusetts for that year, and I said to her right before I left, I said, you know what, I'm going to move, and we're not going to stay in touch, and mm-hmm. You know, I have enjoyed this year, but it's just goodbye. I mean, we'll be friends on Facebook, but you know, we're just not gonna. And she was like, are you breaking up with me?
Yeah.
I was like, no, it's just the way it is. I mean, and we are, we're friends on Facebook, but you know, that's it.
Well, you know, if you're not part of the military community, you don't understand that and so many things.
Yeah.
But yeah, all my friendships were temporary.
Hmm. So I know you went back to Japan as an adult and you found it different and you were disappointed. Part of that is our own expectations that it's going to be exactly the way it was when we were kids. But did you ever go back to other places? Did you ever go back to Kwajalein?
Well, you know, if it weren't for COVID, I would be a yearly visitor to Europe.
Uh-huh.
I'm a sometimes visitor to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I've not returned to the Middle East and I don't plan to.
Mm-hmm.
And as for Kwajalein, I can't go back because it is military and access is restricted.
Oh.
They're still doing their top secret missions down there.
Yeah.
So, and really, I'm not sure why I would. It's so doggone small. There would be nobody that, of course, would know me. It doesn't look the same.
Yeah.
So it's one of those memory pieces that I keep.
Yeah. You know, that is a dilemma of military families. You know, I have mm-hmm. a friend who lives outside of the military base she lived on as a kid, but she can't go on because she has
right.
So she can see it.
Mm-hmm. It's there. Yeah.
She can't do anything with it. And it's kind of a weird dynamic. So in the few minutes we have left, what else would you like to tell our listeners? And then, of course, when is your book coming out and where will they be able to buy it?
Well, you know, I when I saw this question, I had to think about this one a lot. I knew what I wanted to say, but I wasn't sure if I could say it in the right way. The first thing is, and it's something that is on the very first page of the book, is that I've been so blessed. And first and foremost, it was by the enormous gift that I received when I was born into and then raised in the military. And then as a senior citizen, finding this incredible desire and determination to write about my military years, I knew there was a message because I was watching the changes that I'd seen over the decades. And I didn't like what I was seeing. You know, when I was growing up, there was so much recognition and appreciation for the sacrifices of our military. Mm-hmm. The war was over, but people hadn't forgotten the price that they paid mm-hmm. for securing peace and freedom. And it was just amazing. Strangers would stop us on the street when they saw my dad in uniform. And they said much more than thank you for your service. Mm-hmm. They shared personal stories of their own loss and joy, and it was coming from their hearts. And, you know, for me as a kid, that was just an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then I was, you know, 20 or so when the Vietnam War mm-hmm. came along, and mm-hmm. everything changed. Mm-hmm. And I felt so conflicted about that. You know, here I had a brother who was almost military age. I didn't want him to go to Vietnam, and yet that was what we do as military people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to see that whole situation unfold, I find that for a long time, I've worried about the servicemen and their families who continue to give their full measure of devotion. Mm-hmm. But I don't always feel that they get the positive regard and support that they deserve. And certainly they get a lot of criticism. Mm-hmm. So writing this book was an opportunity for me to reach out to my military brothers and sisters and just assure them that, you know, even though I'm an old lady now, I remember that and I love that experience. And I feel like I walk with them. Mm-hmm. They may not have a sense that the civilian population supports them, but if I feel like I walk with them, I know there are a lot of other people just like me mm-hmm. who were so moved by their military experience. You know, I'm in tears when I watch the 4th of July concerts and the Memorial Day concerts. And mm-hmm. I just feel so incredibly close to that military family. Mm-hmm. It's just who I am. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, telling my story was reaching out to those people who may not feel appreciated. I wanted them to feel pride in what they're doing, no matter what they hear on the streets or they see in the newspapers. You know, they are appreciated. And let's see, Fly Butterfly Fly will be available on Amazon.com.
Okay.
Very soon. The cover is being finalized at this very moment.
Good.
And I will let you know when it's available.
Okay.
And I would just like to say to my listeners, you know, if you choose to pick up a copy, I hope you'll enjoy it and find it meaningful and useful. And maybe share it with a friend. And I would love it if you could give me some feedback. And thank you for listening today.
Well, so we've really enjoyed this. And so when it comes out on Amazon, are you going to put an author's page on Amazon with some contact info so that people can email you when they've read it? Or, you know, I don't know how the Amazon author pages work, but everybody seems to have one. Or do you have a website?
I do not have a website yet. Uh-huh. And I'm kind of on the fence about whether I want one. I'm not sure, given the type of book that this is, that there's one that's necessary.
Right.
I have a friend who came from my writing group, who wrote a book about his father-in-law, his war experience. Mm-hmm. And he has found a website very helpful because he's still finding research and data mm-hmm. on this particular time in the war that he wrote about. Mm-hmm. And he posted on his website. But I'm not sure what I would do with a website. So I'm on the fence about that. And because the actual manuscript has not been uploaded yet, there are parts of the Amazon website that I don't have access to. Right. And one of them is the author page.
Right.
But I will be filling that out. There will be ways to get in touch with me, and there are ways to write reviews.
That's really important because, you know, I think I can't say that. A lot of writers write just for the sake of writing because it brings them joy. But then it is nice every once in a while for somebody to say, hey, I really liked what you wrote. It makes you feel validated that maybe, you've touched somebody. So, yeah, I would definitely encourage our listeners, once they buy your book, to reach out and say, hey, I enjoyed that, or that made me think, or I had no idea where the Marshall Islands are, or something like that.
Well, that was my intent.
So I really appreciate your taking the time today to speak to us. I thought this was very interesting. I know from the museum Facebook page, because when you sent the proof book, I posted a picture of it and said, hey, I'm reading this. And I had some people say, oh, I'd like to read that too. And I said, well, it's going to be out really soon. So there is some interest in your book, and I wish you a lot of luck in it. And we look forward. And so, of course, once you get it up and out, send us a press release or a link or something, and we'd be happy to let our listeners, and we'll post it up on the museum page, you know, so that people know that it's available.
We do that.
Okay, good. So once again, we have to wrap it up. This has been Circe, that's me, and our podcast, At Ease. Our museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. And our guest today has been Frances Kirkham, and she is the author of a very fascinating book called Fly, Butterfly, Fly. And so thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, and it's certainly been my pleasure.